Welcome everyone to this afternoon session of this fantastic Marxism 2018 conference. My name's Tess. I'm from Socialist Alternative, one of the Melbourne branches, and I'll be chairing this session. So this is a session on who controls data, privacy, corporations and the state, and our speaker is Michael Candelaars. And Michael is a long-term socialist, but he's particularly well qualified to speak on this topic because he is an IT worker. And he informs me he helped set up one of the first secure drop systems in Australia. Now, I'm technologically ignorant, but I understand that that is a service that actually helps and protects people who want to leak sensitive stuff. So that's a very worthwhile thing to do. So Mike is going to speak, and then, as usual, we'll have time for questions and discussion. So take it away, Mikey.
Thank you. Okay, so in 1993, the US magazine The New Yorker published this cartoon. Unfortunately, due to technical issues, I can't actually read the quote down the bottom, which is the most important part of the cartoon. But I'll read it to you. It says, "On the internet, nobody knows you're a dog." Now, this was published, I think, in 1993, when the internet was still very much in its infancy. And this rang very true at the time. You could go online, you could be whoever you wanted to be, you could use whatever name you wanted, you could talk to whoever you wanted to, and the tools to track you down and to get your real name simply just did not exist at the time. And the internet was very much known for its ability for people to truly be anonymous. Fast forward 25 years to today, this is a very different situation. Absolutely everything we do on the internet now is tracked and traced. And increasingly, all of our electronic devices are connected to the internet and are either intentionally or unintentionally used to spy on us. Our personal information is harvested and sold to whoever is willing to pay. And whilst private companies spy on us for profit, nation states do this as a form, they use the same technology as a form of mass surveillance. Which is why it's not without a cruel sense of irony that in 2008, Malcolm Turnbull tweeted, "My favourite cartoon is the New Yorker one, with the two dogs and the caption that reads, 'On the internet, no one knows you're a dog.'" Of course, Malcolm Turnbull being the person that helped introduce mandatory metadata legislation here in Australia. And it's a very exciting time to be talking about issues of data privacy and surveillance, given the current scandal that's happening at the moment with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. And there's now a serious discussion about data privacy in society, which I think is fantastic. And I hope throughout this talk I want to really add to these discussions that are taking place in society, but also to talk about how the problems of surveillance and privacy, data capture, all this is not just about Facebook. They are certainly part of the problem, but they're not just the problem. In fact, as I want to explain, the entire business model of the internet is now predicated on surveillance. And I want to talk about this relationship between private companies and the state and how the rise of mass surveillance fits in with an understanding of capitalism. So, first off, we need to define what we mean by data and what the kinds of information about us that's even being recorded. Electronic devices, computers, they all produce data. Inputs and outputs. This is very fundamental into how they work. And computers are now part of almost everything that we use on a daily basis. Our cars, our fridges, our mobile phones, which is undoubtedly the most sophisticated surveillance device in history. They are all producing enormous amounts of data. I can guarantee that all of you, I'm assuming almost everyone here has a phone on them, your phone is producing some kind of data at the moment. So you think even just the act of walking out of your house and going to work each day, you're producing data. Your phone is constantly sending location data to mobile phone towers. It's sending your location, your speed, your direction of travel. Most modern cars record your driving habits. You think of all the CCTV cameras you're driving past, license plate scanners. All these things are recording data. If you go into a shopping centre, for instance, you're producing even more data. Where you walk to, what shops you go to, what shelves you go to in the supermarket, how long you look at advertisements for, your facial expression while you're doing this. All of this is data which is and can be captured. Now you think, you haven't even taken your phone out of your pocket yet. If you actually do that, you're producing, again, more data. What websites you visit, who you email, what emails you open, how far you scroll, what links you click on, who you message on Facebook, who you're friends with, who you talk to. Can't get in the picture. I'm talking about absolutely everything here. What angle you hold your phone at. This is all data which exists. What you search for. And there can be some really private stuff in what you search for, because you think about it, we don't lie to Google in the same way that we do to other human beings. We're actually incredibly honest to Google. So our search history reveals a hell of a lot about us, our fears, our insecurities, our health problems, our perceived health problems, what we're going to buy next. All these things exist. And is likely, to be honest, it's owned by Google. It's a real common feature in most Android phones now that if you have an upcoming flight and your receipt is in your email, you'll get a little notification on the day of your flight letting you know what time it departs, what time you need to leave the house based on where you currently are, what gate you need to go to, etc. Our phones are constantly listening to us, and there's new assistants that you get in phones like Google Now and Siri are encouraged to let them train our voice so they can respond to us. In fact, almost everything that I've said so far in this talk has been analysed by my phone and likely some of yours. And for anyone that's got an Android phone, every time I've said the word okay, it has recorded the next 20 seconds of audio. And if you're in this category, you can actually log into your Google account and you can view all the recordings that it's made. And having done this a few weeks ago, pretty frightening the sort of stuff that you'll find in there. In particular, some of the things of my two-year-old saying Google to my phone. I've got lots of recordings of this now, which is just frightening. And it's generally pretty accurate. I mean, it can distinguish between me saying, okay, where is a good place to eat? And okay, Google, where is a good place to eat? There you go. So today when we talk about data and surveillance, I'm not simply talking about just what you do on the internet being recorded. I'm talking about absolutely everything you do, from the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to sleep. And if you wear a fitness tracker, which I can see a few people here do, it's also recording data while you're sleeping as well. Now, I'm sure there's going to be some of you in the room that might be thinking, really, what's so bad about this? Like, surely some of these things, are useful. Like, if you've got a flight coming up, it's kind of useful that you get a notification on your phone telling you where you need to go to. And as someone who works in IT, I always find myself getting caught between, finding these technologies as being actually really cool and interesting, but then when you start to dive into them, realizing how scary and frightening they actually are. But we use a lot of these tools precisely because they are useful. They do improve our lives in many ways. Most importantly, they're free. But as the old saying goes, if you're not paying for something, then you're the product. All that data that we produce is a valuable commodity, which is bought and sold. In the hands of private companies, it is used to market commodities to us, and in the hands of the nation states, it is used to surveil us. Now, during Donald Trump's quite horrific campaign to get elected, one of the many abhorrent things he said was to praise the book Fountainhead, written by Ayn Rand. And this is a book written during the Cold War, and it's a story, sort of a parable of the power of the individual capitalist being greater than that of the collective. And it was meant to be a real parable, about how the West is so much better than so-called communist Russia. And in the book, Ayn Rand comments how civilization is the progress towards a society of privacy. And at the time, there's plenty of defenders of capitalism who would have supported this, that would have argued that capitalism is synonymous with privacy. Fast forward today now, there is no modern ideologue of modern capitalism that talks about the importance of privacy. Instead now, the idea is very much, if you have nothing, you got nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, nothing to hide. Now, there are many that have tried to name these times that we're in. Ubervalence, digital capitalism, perhaps more accurate, surveillance capitalism. But regardless of exactly what we want to call it, as we'll see, surveillance has become normalized, and at the core of it is the desire for profit by a tiny minority of society. In the early days of the internet, there wasn't a lot of ways that you could make money from it. And the idea of paying for services or content on the internet was never one that really took off. However, advertising became the key way the websites could start to generate revenue, with the key difference from traditional advertising meaning that advertisements could be targeted to who's on the site. And this idea of having tailored advertisements actually solves one of the key problems that has plagued the advertising industry for a very long time. A man called John Wanamaker, who has a great name, but he was a capitalist in the United States in the early 19th century and is widely seen as one of the pioneers of modern marketing. And he once said, "Half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. The trouble is, I don't know which half." And it's true. If you think about it, if you run advertisements on television or radio for Rolexes, there's going to be a lot of poor working class people who can't afford Rolexes who are going to be marketed to. In the eyes of these sorts of people, this is wasted money. But the internet, however, gives these people the opportunity to run ads targeted to people based, who have a particular income, particular gender, a particular purchase history, and so much more. But to start doing this, websites needed to start collecting data on their users. And this has effectively become the business model of some of the largest companies on the planet. Almost every website now collects data about who visits their sites and has become in their best interest to collect absolutely as much data as possible so that this can be onsold onto third parties to market to us. According to the security researcher Bruce Schneier, he said, "These companies are analogous to feudal lords, and we are their vassals, peasants, and on a bad day, serfs. We are tenant farmers for these companies, working on their land by producing data that they in turn sell for profit." And profit they do. It's estimated that in 2017, around $200 billion was spent on online advertisements in the US alone, with the overwhelming majority of that going to two companies, Google and Facebook. Now, when we start to look at a company like Facebook, the amount of data that they harvest on their users means that they can offer advertisers a phenomenal level of targeting. And on their website, they say that advertisers can select people based on their prior purchase behaviours, device usage, and other activities. For example, if you're a shoe shop, you can target people who've recently purchased shoes. Now, everything that you post on Facebook, every public post, every private message that you send, is actually analysed by Facebook and you're categorised according to the things that you post. So if you want to target people that have bought shoes, you can do that. You might be surprised about what sort of groups you can actually target. Last year, the investigative news organisation ProPublica discovered that they could buy Facebook advertisements that specifically targeted anti-Semites. For $30, you could buy ads that only people identified as Jew haters would see on Facebook. And you could advertise anything you want to them, try to get them along to a meeting, try and organize them, try and sell them shoes, whatever the hell you wanted, you could do that. But this is not the first time that Facebook has had fairly unscrupulous advertising categories. Last year, it was reported that Facebook was offering advertising space to teenagers here in Australia based on their current emotional state. And they had been able to categorise them into the following 10 categories of worthless, insecure, defeated, anxious, silly, useless, stupid, overwhelmed, stressed, and feeling a failure. And frightening. And if all that wasn't bad enough, in 2014, it was revealed that Facebook conducted what it thought was a fairly interesting social experiment on 700,000 of its Facebook users, where they showed either a disproportionate amount of happy or sad content in people's news feeds just to see how people reacted online. So this is a company that not only uses our private data and owns all of it, but it uses that information to manipulate our emotions, to spy on us, to categorize all of us, so it can deliver better advertisements to us and, of course, make more money. In fact, 98% of Facebook's revenue comes from advertising. So at the moment, when you hear Mark Zuckerberg really crying crocodile tears about how, you know, upset he is about the misuse of data from Cambridge Analytica, I think we should remind ourselves that this would be like a weapons manufacturer complaining about wars in the world, that, you know, profiling, misusing data, this is entirely what Facebook is about. This is their business model. But the level of spying is not just limited to the online world. It's becoming increasingly common for most organizations to collect data on us. Take shopping centers, for instance. If you are here in Melbourne, if you've ever been to Chadstone or Emporium or really any of the big shopping centres, you'll notice that they offer free Wi-Fi. They've got signs like this, up saying, you know, Wi-Fi in store. You're accepting a privacy policy by entering the store. I had the fun job of reading some of the privacy policies of these organisations. It's quite interesting what you find in them. And we should remember that there's a real point about the Wi-Fi is free, but as I mentioned before, you know, if you're not paying for it, you are the product. So in their privacy policy for, this is Westfield, so all the major shopping centres here, they say that they record the different areas of a centre you have visited, your present location within a centre, websites accessed, and that they may send special discounts on deals based on web usage. How is this used? Well, an example is provided by Sue Mitchell, who wrote a piece about Westfield spying in the Sydney Morning Herald. And she wrote, when a customer shopping for suits in a department store Googles a rival store, a report is then sent to the retailer's marketing team, which may choose to respond by sending the customer an email offering a discount. And that can come either like a text message you might get while you're in store or an email. But really some of the most Orwellian services we're seeing popping up at the moment are being rolled out by the company Bell Morgan. If you've been to a petrol station recently, you might have noticed that you're getting these little screens that are popping up offering, you know, advertisements. You're seeing a few people nodding. The new ones have got a camera in there. And the Bell Morgan website, aside from saying that, you know, rich audience is in purchase mode, kind of marketing waffle. But they claim on their website, if you read through, that they use facial recognition on these cameras to determine who is looking at the ad, and the ad changes, and it's based on your age, gender, and your current mood, based on your facial expression when you're looking at the ad. That's pretty Orwellian stuff. The final example in this that I want to say something about is supermarkets, in particular Woolworths. They've come under fire quite a bit recently for their spying on gamblers, which is not what I want to talk about. But I want to say something about their rewards cards. You're always encouraged to get one if you've ever been to Woolworths, because you know it saves you money and you know it's going to make your life better, whatever. But again, if you read through their privacy policy, you find some interesting stuff. So they say, at times, we combine different sets of data to add to the personal information we hold. An example of this is a history of a member's transactions from use of the same payment card. So you think about this. If you shop at Woolies and then you go and shop at another store, i.e. Coles, using the same bank card, they could potentially have access to this information. As for what they do with this data, one of the key things they say in their privacy policy is it's used to deliver tailored advertising, including banner advertisements on websites you visit, and tailored advertisements on social media platforms about products and services that may interest you. So in effect, what can happen, you could go into Woolworths, make a purchase, and then later in that day, get an ad on Facebook related to what you've done in store. And it's not just Woolworths that do this. It's one of the known marketing strategies of the pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson, is to target Facebook ads to people who've recently bought their rivals' products. Now, again, at this point, I'm sure some of you could be forgiven for thinking, you know, well, it's pretty scary. You know, surely getting a few banner advertisements, you know, online, like, that's not the worst thing in the world, surely. But the reality is that now that this enormous amount of information exists on all of us, on millions of us, and provides a very high level of detail into our lives, this data is increasingly being used and analysed by insurance companies, security firms, companies like Cambridge Analytica, our employers, and the state as a means of mass surveillance. In fact, in the US alone, there are over 4,000 companies that are data brokers. Their specific job is to buy and sell personal information data, and of course, to profit from this. But what we're now seeing are what we call big data, which is all about pooling together all of this data that exists, that's floating around about all of us, and using modern computing power to analyze this, to look at it. And what we're seeing is increasingly this being used as a new way to discriminate against us. Now, institutionalized data collection and discrimination has existed for a long time. For instance, in Australia in the 1930s, if you applied to get any welfare money, the state would collect data on you. They would send people to your house, they would interview your neighbours, you know, they'd look at what you bought, like they'd do an analysis on you to see if you were, you know, deserving poor. One of the most well-known examples of institutionalized racism was the policy of redlining, which, for those who don't know, was a policy of segregation in the United States, where banks would refuse loans to people if you were African-American or if you were generally poor, if you tried to get a house in particular suburbs, and they literally drew red lines on maps to decide this. Now, civil rights legislation that was won in the 1960s made these sorts of quite explicit policies illegal. However, with big data, we're now seeing what people are calling web lining. For example, it's now common for banks that they can lower your credit limit based on where you shop. There was a story a couple of years ago of a man in the US who, having returned from his honeymoon, received a letter from his bank informing him that his credit limit had been lowered by $7,000 because other customers who have used their card at establishments where you recently shopped have a poor repayment history with American Express. So, literally, you could be denied a home loan for going somewhere like Nando's on the basis that there's other people that have gone to Nando's that haven't paid a bill or something like that. That you're guilty by association with big data. It's well known that welfare can be denied to you on the basis of your marital status. We now know that the IRS in the US does bulk analysis of people's Facebook photos to determine their relationship status. And in the wake of Trump's immigration or Muslim ban, it was quite rightfully called, it's now common that when visiting the US, that people have had to actually hand over their mobile phones and show their Facebook profiles before being allowed entry into the United States. And information by private phone companies, all this is accessible by the state. This was used, for example, in 2014 when the Ukrainian government sent a very Orwellian text message to thousands of its citizens who attended a demonstration. The message read, "Dear subscriber, you have been registered as a participant in a mass disturbance." Imagine getting that, it's pretty scary stuff. But this exact same technique has—it's been documented. It's been used in the United States by police in Michigan to monitor union demonstrations, and here in Melbourne, Victoria Police actually use mobile phone data to estimate the crowds at events like Moomba. Now, whether they use this information on protests, it's not publicly known. But the ability to do this, the data exists. It's all possible for them to do this, and fairly likely that they do. And that gets you who's there, where people have walked to, where they've come from, all this sort of quite detailed information. And there's countless more examples I can rattle off to you here, but as I hope you start to see, the line between private collection of data by private companies and the state, the line between those very much starts to blur. But there's a clear relationship that exists between the two. And it's very much thanks to whistleblowers like Edward Snowden that we now know that pretty much all the data that I've talked about here today, the US government has firm access to. And through its intelligence agreement, quite Orwellingly called the Five Eyes, the governments of the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia have access to this too. Now, they have access to this data either because they bulk collect people's data themselves, which is one of the big things that Snowden released, or it's through private agreements and deals with these companies, or it's just through brute force hacking and compulsion. For example, their tech company, Yahoo, initially actually refused to be a part of the US's domestic spying program, and they were threatened with a $250,000 daily fine until they acquiesced. And needless to say, they did acquiesce and they did sign. It's also important to say that Microsoft, Google, Facebook, they didn't even put up token resistance to this. They happily kind of signed on to this. Now, we know the most about US domestic surveillance because of Edward Snowden. But it would be absolutely naive to not think that other countries, China, Russia, obviously all the Western states, they do the same thing. It's just that there's not as much publicly known about some of these other states. Okay, so our private lives are not really private. So how can we understand how all this has happened? Well, to fully appreciate how normalized surveillance has now become, I think we need to understand that behind it, it's been the coming together of a few factors. Firstly, we've seen the rise of the internet out of mass data collection by corporations. And secondly, the storage of all of this data has now become incredibly cheap, and computers are now powerful enough that all of this data can be very quickly and cheaply analysed by most companies. And all this has happened in a very short period of time. Like, we're talking about the last 20 years. But you've also got to think about what else has happened in the last 20 years. September 11, the war on terror, the global financial crisis, revolutions across the Arab world. And now we're seeing the decline of the United States as a dominant power in the world and the rise of other countries like China and Russia. And it was really the war on terror, which started in the early 2000s, really began this new era of an erosion of our civil liberties, which we're currently living in, and a real strengthening of the security apparatuses of most states, greater police powers, and expanded surveillance powers. So nation states, the last 20 years, they've wanted to increase domestic surveillance on all of us. But at the same time, we're seeing increased tension between nation states themselves, and more espionage, surveillance between each other. I think it's becoming far more common. And all of this has led to a situation where on the question of surveillance, the interests of corporations and the state are very firmly intertwined. Now, despite what Ayn Rand might have you believe, capitalism has never been about privacy, or greater privacy. For the elite, perhaps, but certainly not for ordinary people or any of us here in this room. At the time that she wrote the book Fountainhead, the communist witch hunts in America in the 1950s were very much alive. And here in Australia, the formation of ASIO meant spying on the political left and monitoring dissent. And it was pretty well understood that if you went to an anti-war demonstration in the 60s or 70s, you would likely get a file. It's not unreasonable to suggest that you might be followed around by agents. Fast forward to today. This, of course, still continues today. But what is different now is the scale. That in the past, ASIO had to employ fairly vast resources to follow around specific people. Today, they can pretty much surveil everyone with far less resources. The driving factor in all of this is capitalism itself, a system fundamentally divided by class, where today the top 1% of the population owns and controls the vast majority of the world's wealth. And being a tiny minority in society, the world's rich and powerful, they can't rule society alone just by their sheer numbers. They don't have that on their side. They need other things. They need political institutions. They need laws. They need police, armies, ideologies. justify their position. And despite all of the pretenses that we have towards democracy in the West, the key decisions in society are not made by us. They are predominantly made by unelected people, heads of corporations, CEOs, and their willing partners in Parliament. And the workplace, where most of us spend the majority of our lives, is certainly not a democracy. It's effectively a dictatorship, where we're told what to do, when to do it, how fast, how safely to work, all for the enrichment of our employer. So a major aspect of capitalism, it is about social control, either through direct force in countries that are dictatorships, like China, or through the illusion of democracy that we have here in Australia. I think what we're starting to see is this mass surveillance is becoming a part of this social control. Obviously, it varies from country to country. In places like Turkey or Ukraine or China, I think that surveillance of your device, of everything you do, is a much greater part of social control. There's people that are openly arrested, jailed, for things that they're posted. There was quite a famous quote by one of the former NSA directors a couple of years ago, US General Michael Hayden, who said, "We kill people based on metadata." And it's true. This data has real impact on people's lives. In a country like Australia, I certainly don't want to overstate the impact that surveillance has on political struggle. I think that the political weakness of our trade unions, of the Labor Party, politics of reformism, I think all of these things are much more decisive factors today. But surveillance is increasingly everywhere around us. In the public service, you can be sacked for posts on social media that are critical of government policy. It's pretty standard company policy that management can read your emails. These things can all be accessed by them. And more Orwellian example, late last year, the bank Westpac announced that in some of their workplaces, they're going to be introducing cameras with facial recognition to, quote, read the mood of staff and tell managers if a pep-up is needed. Now, things are, again, frightening, but these are bound to have an effect on people's confidence in the workplace to be able to speak up and, of course, in society more broadly. But the final example of, the final aspect of surveillance that I want to talk about here is encryption. One of the important things that we did learn from all the documents released by Snowden is that modern encryption, done right, works. It works very well. And it's a good thing that today, since in the 4 years since Snowden, about half of all internet traffic is now encrypted. So now there is a debate about governments wanting to break encryption. I think that is a big part of what's behind it. Now, say a few things about encryption, because the idea of encryption, of keeping information private by encrypting it, sounds like a very new kind of modern concept. Actually, a very old one. Plenty of human societies before capitalism developed methods for encryption. Take this, for example. This is called a stipule. Circa 7th century BC, it's quite old. It was basically a piece of wood, hexagon-shaped, and you'd have a piece of leather that you'd kind of wrap around it, and you'd write whatever message you wanted on it. And then you could unfurl that. And the only way to decrypt it was to have another kind of hexagon-shaped bit of wood that you could wrap around and read it. Of course, this was a way of transmitting information and being effectively encrypted. Perhaps when some of you were younger, you might have written letters to people and encrypted it by thinking you were very clever by substituting different letters for different things, like every A for a B or B for a C, and you get kind of gibberish. And you probably thought you were very clever when you did that, and you were. Unfortunately, you're not very... that's the kind of... the methodology. You're very clever, but you weren't very original. In cryptography, that's called a Caesar cipher, named after one Julius Caesar, because that was his preferred method of encrypting information, private and military communications. Now, today, encryption has become a long way since then with modern computing. But most importantly, encryption has become universal. But unlike in the past, where different nation states would have their own methods of encrypting information, their own machines with their own unique settings. People have ever read about, you know, much about World War II, kind of association of encryption is the Enigma machine, these physical machines that encrypted information and that had their own specific settings and rotors on them. So different countries had their own methods of encrypting things, and it was a real fight between different nation states to try and decrypt their communications. But today, it's the same methodologies are used to encrypt internet traffic as it is to encrypt data on your phone or internet traffic, no matter where you are in the world. It's the same kind of maps and processes that are going on. So why does all of this matter? Why am I even talking about it? Well, if you think what the CIA were doing during the Cold War, espionage consisted primarily of trying to break Russian communication methods, you know, using Russian-made hardware, Russian tools. But today, the technology globally is pretty much the same. It travels along the same cables as everyone else, the same devices, the same operating systems. So as nation states are increasingly trying to spy on each other, this means spying on internet traffic. It means being able to break into iPhones, into WhatsApp, and this, of course, means spying all of us. So there's this relationship between the surveillance of capitalists, on themselves, between nation states, and spying on all of us. And I think this is a really important driver of domestic surveillance today. Now, at the moment, there's a real debate going on at the moment with the likes of Malcolm Turnbull, Theresa May, and the FBI all pushing for tech companies to either break their encryption or to introduce backdoors into their operating systems or their software to be able to access things like WhatsApp messages that you read. So in other words, they think that your data should be private unless the government wants to read it, which of course, when you think about this, is a very absurd concept. But at the heart of it, it's absurd for many reasons, but you can't build some kind of magical, decrypt communication button, that they can press and not have this accessible for other people, that it would only be a matter of time. You couldn't build a tool like that that worked by judging the morality of the person that pressed it. That once you build these kind of backdoors in so that the state can access something, well, it's not very far before everything becomes public. Everything could be decrypted. So I think it's vital, many reasons, that we oppose our governments trying to do this. We should have a right to privacy, the right to communicate with who we want to, and to be absolutely free of government surveillance. So to start to sum up, over the past 20 years, surveillance has become normalised and ubiquitous. And the world envisioned by George Orwell in his book 1984 increasingly feels closer to home as our data, our location, our personal information is harvested by corporations and by our governments. And with this current scandal to do with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, it is really welcome to see a spotlight shone on them at the moment. And the world, really being shown the sheer scale of data, of information about us that exists, and how it is misused. But as I hope to have explained through this talk, the problem is not just Facebook. Surveillance has become the business model for the internet. And increasingly, we are seeing this data being used against us. And whistleblowers have really shown us the full extent to this. But the problem of just exposing the ills of this world, it's no guarantee that things are automatically going to change. And this is one of the real tragedies of all the data that's been released and leaked by Edward Snowden. He exposed to the world the full extent of global and domestic surveillance by the US and the NSA. But 4 years on, when you look at the state of surveillance, almost every single spying program in the United States that had been scaled back to some extent post-Snowden's release has been reintroduced by Donald Trump. In Australia, we now have mandatory metadata legislation. So the storage of pretty much everything that we do online is recorded. And similar programs exist in the UK, Canada, Russia, countless others. The level of surveillance is now far worse today than it was 4 years ago. So we need whistleblowers. They're important, and it's great. We need more of them. But we need to understand that surveillance has become a core part of modern capitalism. Not just the growing advertising industry, but political crisis, imperialism, and the more unstable world that we're heading towards are all drivers towards expanded surveillance. So it's going to take much more than simple, you know, reform or stronger regulation on data collection, or all of us kind of, you know, going dark and throwing our phones in the bin and not using any technology. You cannot escape surveillance today. There's obviously things that you can do, like get a VPN or use Signal Messenger or things like that. They're all very important things that people can do to help make themselves more secure. But surveillance on the, you know, the big scale, it is almost unavoidable. But so we need to look at not just, you know, simple, you know, reform or more regulation, you know, things like that. We need to get rid of this whole system that puts profit ahead of absolutely everything else, and it seeks to turn every single aspect of our lives, of, you know, what we do on our phones, like all of this, and, you know, trying to turn all those things into commodities. We should not be afraid of governments. As the saying goes, they should be afraid of us. So I want to end with the words of Edward Snowden, who made a very important call to action in 2013, when he said, "In the end, the Obama administration is not afraid of whistleblowers like me, Manning, or Thomas Drake. We are stateless, imprisoned, or powerless. No, the Obama administration is afraid of you. It is afraid of an informed, angry public, and it should be." Thank you.